Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Sorry, I've been changing the schedule a little bit here, but today we're going to have a very exciting guest, Marlene Haffner, who is the former head of the Orphan Drug Department at the Food and Drug Administration, is going to be with us today, and I think we'll have a really exciting conversation. So I wanted to remind you first that this program is brought to you by the VHL, Family Alliance. That's like veryhappylife.org. And we wanted you to know a little bit about VHL, about your host. So I'm going to play you a few words about VHL, and then we'll be back to talk with Marlene. Thanks.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thanks for listening, and we're back with The Powerful Patient. Just to remind you, there will be a handout that goes with this show, which you can find at powerfulpatient.org, and you can sign up there for the podcast subscription so that you can see the various kinds of programs that we've done over the last couple of years. It'll be 2 years this September that we've been doing Powerful Patient every week to bring information to people who have complex medical conditions and disabilities and help them learn how to manage their health. So I'd like to welcome at this time Dr. Marlene Haffner. Hi, Marlene.
Hi, how are you, Joyce? Nice to speak with you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You have quite a varied career that spans, more than 30 years. And I wondered if we could start off talking a little bit about how you got interested in rare diseases and some of the work that you did out in the Southwest in the 1970s.
Great. Well, I think I've always been interested in rare diseases. I've always been interested in minute facts that are very important. And whether this led me in this direction or not, I don't know. But as a young physician, my training, besides internal medicine, was in hematology and specifically in rare hemoglobins. Now, many people are knowledgeable a bit about sickle cell disease, and I was studying many hemoglobins that had never been characterized before. So that certainly was rare diseases and sparked my interest. From there, my husband and I went to work on the Navajo Reservation, in part because he had at that time, draft obligation for the war in Vietnam. We loved it. We thought we would go for 2 years. We stayed for 10 years. We both had exciting, challenging, and satisfying careers working with the Navajo patients. And they are people like every one of the rest of us. But among the things I learned were different cultures look at disease and look at issues of lifestyle differently. And just because I think something is the way it should be done, they may not, or an individual may not. And so that was an excellent learning experience.
So this was not just like being an old-fashioned country doctor. It was more than that. You were helping people with sanitation and good water and long-term care and just about everything.
Well, that's true. I went out there as a regular doctor. I went out there as the chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine in one of the larger hospitals. But because I like to get involved in things, within 3.5-4 years, I became the administrator for the entire Navajo health program. The Navajo Reservation is roughly the size of the state of West Virginia. It's large.
Yeah, and it spans several states, too, doesn't it?
It does. New Mexico, Arizona, and parts of Utah. Now, obviously, not all of those states. But
right, right.
It's a large part of it. And my responsibilities were, as you said, making sure that acute care was well given, that water and sanitation was being installed, that there was good preventive health care put in place, that there was dental care, home health care, a real public health program, broader than most that we all know.
Can you give us one example of a sort of cultural difference that you ran into?
Well, the Navajo language is a language that was only written within the last 30 years. But in the Navajo language, and many of the older people were speakers primarily of Navajo, if one says to a patient, "I am very sorry that such and such happened, that your child is ill, that your aunt died," whatever the issue is, the translation is, "It was my fault."
Ah.
That's an important difference.
Right.
And one, you know, that you need to learn very early on. Another difference is, you know, we walk in and to somebody's house and it's good morning, good afternoon, how are you, what's going on? In the Navajo language, you may say good morning, good afternoon, and then you sit for a while, and everybody's quiet, and then eventually conversation begins. But we're very much upfront and outspoken, and that simply is not the case.
So it's considered rude if you do that?
You bet.
Uh-huh.
You bet. And then there are other cultural things. I was a young woman at the time. As the director of the program, I was raised that you make eye contact with people.
Mm-hmm.
Among Navajos, if you are making eye contact with a man, that is not considered appropriate. You're supposed to focus on the nose or the cheeks. Similar to, you know, many Asian cultures who don't have the direct eye contact that we do. So in order to be accepted as someone that was useful to them and providing good services, I had to learn a lot about the way they looked at things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's even more stark when you're in a different culture. Even within our own culture, we have different ways of looking at things. But when you add in the cultural differences, the distance between what you're thinking and what the other person's thinking can be much greater.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially remember that, you know, at the time the patient is talking to you, they're under stress. They've come because either they or their family member is ill.
Right.
And so that adds to the equation.
Did you encounter a certain amount of distrust of the medical system?
Not
people who
really
thought that they'd be better off going to the medicine man?
Well, a lot of people did go to the medicine man. And we worked closely with there's a school for medicine men. And we had an ongoing, had ongoing conversations with the medicine men. Many times a patient, you would say to them, you know, you need your gallbladder out, or you need this or that procedure. And the patient would say, well, yeah, I will have that done, but first I need to go home and have a native ceremony called a sing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they had that, they were well prepared. Were there some charlatans? Sure. There are some weird people everywhere. But in general, we developed a good rapport. And as long as we respected their beliefs, they came to respect ours as well.
So in preparing yourself for surgery, it's important to prepare yourself emotionally and in terms of your own stress, too. We often recommend meditation and different kinds of things to get your body ready to undergo this challenge. And so in a sense, that's the purpose of the thing that you were talking about, for people to go and feel that they're in tune with their bodies and in tune with the universe and that they're going to come through this okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's also herbal medicine in many places. Is that, did that also play a role out there? And
There are some herbal medicines, but I didn't become terribly familiar with them.
Right, so you didn't run into any interaction problems, but sometimes that can be.
Well, there certainly can be, but that was not an issue that was an issue for me.
So you were part of the Public Health Service, which is a uniformed sort of, what, quasi-military kind of organization?
That is correct. It is one of the 7 federal uniformed services.
And you became an admiral.
I did.
Which has nothing to do with boats?
Which has nothing to do with boats. In the Public Health Service, our weapons are medications to treat disease.
Mm-hmm.
And our war is against disease and against illness and in providing preventive health care measures. So that people do not become ill.
Right.
Public Health Service is part of Department of Health and Human Services.
Right. So it has a chain of command that would be similar to the military and a ranking system that's similar to the military.
Yes, the ranking system is the same as the Navy ranking system. So
okay.
I eventually was promoted to a 2-star admiral.
And you went to the Food and Drug Administration?
I did. I spent 25 years working in the Food and Drug Administration. The first 5 years I worked in a very new program, which was the Bureau, it was called a Bureau of Medical Devices. And then at the end of 5 years, the Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration asked me if I would like to take on the responsibility of another fairly new program called the Office of Orphan Products Development. And I spent 20 wonderful, exciting, creative years there, which I enjoyed every moment.
That's great. So this was when this program was born, right? This was brand new.
It was almost brand new. The first director was a physician, Marion Finkel, who had felt very strongly about the needs of patients with rare diseases and was instrumental in assisting in the establishment of a committee that looked at what were then called significant drugs of little commercial value. They wrote a report, that committee did, that resulted in legislation, which was signed into law in 1983. And I came into the program in 1986. I was the second permanent director of the program.
So why is there a need for a separate program to deal with rare diseases?
think that everyone has read about the high cost of drugs and drug development. If you are developing a new drug, if you are a pharmaceutical company, and you have discovered a compound that looks promising, it takes a long time and a significant amount of money. One estimate is as much as $1 billion to develop a new product. If your patient population is only 500 in the United States, making a return on that investment is virtually impossible. And so incentives were developed to assist drug manufacturers so that they could afford to develop drugs for rare diseases. Program has been very, very successful. There are well over 300 drugs that have been developed, not nearly enough, but a lot more than existed prior to the passage of the Orphan Drug Act.
So what kinds of incentives? I mean, there's some copyright protection, for example, but are there any reductions in cost or reductions in processing to get such a drug to market?
There are many incentives. The incentive that is most often talked about is 7 years marketing exclusivity. Many of these drugs, at least initially, were, if not off-patent, close to off-patent. So some kind of personal property patent protection was needed. So the 7 years exclusive marketing rights for that drug, for that disease, is very important.
So, and for example, if I spend, $40 million figuring out what drug is going to be helpful for this condition, and then I bring it to market, and I can have exclusive rights to market that for a certain period of time, but after that, somebody else could go get my patent information from the patent office and copy it and sell it cheaper because they didn't have the startup cost.
That's true with all patents, of course.
Right.
What has been shown is that even at the end of 7 years, while there are some drugs that then become generic drugs, the majority do not. And the reasons for that are that the populations in most instances are indeed small, and there's simply not enough market to divide that market in two or three between the originator and generic manufacturers. But even so, for a public company, shareholders want to know that their investment is safe at least for the 7 years of exclusive marketing rights. But there are other incentives as well. There are tax credits, which are particularly important for small and medium-sized firms. Those tax credits are for clinical development. There is the assistance of the Office of Orphan Products Development, which is not an inconsequential thing, because that office will work with manufacturers in order to help them with the best way to develop their drug. Then there's a waiver of what are called filing fees. If you are a manufacturer or a developer and you are submitting a drug to FDA for review to be able to market the product, the current expense for that is about $1 million. If you're developing an orphan drug that's designated as an orphan drug, then that $1 million fee is waived. That's a significant benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other benefits as well that may or may not be used as much. There's a grants program, very valuable for academic researchers because they can show them that their product has some utility It's usually for very early clinical trials. But if it works in that disease, it gives enough information to a drug company that they might be willing to further develop the product. Mm-hmm. So that's another incentive. There are open protocols in those situations in which it was felt that it might be very difficult to get a product to market just because of the small size of the population. There would be the ability to at least recoup costs and make it available to patients in need. So there's a fair amount of direct incentives from the law. In addition, that law and its consequences have brought lots of interest around the world to the plight of patients with rare diseases. So we have now, or there are now, orphan drug programs in the European Union, in Japan, in Australia, in Taiwan, in Singapore, in South Korea, and those are the ones that I best know about. I'm sure there are others. And there are an increasing number of conferences. There are an increasing number of rare disease support groups to help patients. So interest has been generated to assist patients, and that can only be good.
Yes, and many of these rare disease programs were really modeled on the work that you did at the FDA.
Most of them were actually modeled. Many of them existed a little bit. But when they knew that there was help, that increased the interest. And then there is, of course, the umbrella organization, NORD, the National Organization for Rare Disorders, which represents all of their membership, and I'm not sure exactly how many members there are to NORD, but represents them in lobbying efforts and in funding efforts and those sorts of things.
Right. So many of the pharmaceuticals try to find that blockbuster drug, that drug that they're going to sell umpty zillion copies of it, and so they could even, you know, charge $5 a bottle and still make a whole bunch of money because they're selling so many. But with rare diseases, that's not the case. And so part of it is the size of the market. Part of it, though, too, is how many times a day is this person going to have to take this drug, or how many years are they going to have to take the drug? So many times, you know, we take it for a headache or whatever, a headache goes away, we don't take it anymore. But when you're taking a drug to counteract some rare disease, you may have to take this drug for the rest of your life.
You're absolutely correct. While not all rare diseases are chronic diseases, by far and away, most of them are. Mm-hmm. And as a result, these products are taken by the patient for long periods of time.
Right. So part of the issue from the patient's perspective is we definitely want them to do this work. We want them to make some money so that they stay in business and can do this good work. But at the same time, the drug needs to be affordable, and balancing that is really sometimes very difficult. Some of these new drugs, it can cost you $70,000 to $100,000 for 1 year to take the drug.
Absolutely, and that's a very difficult situation. Many of the drug manufacturers work with insurance groups or insurance companies so that patients can get the drug, but it's not always simple, and it's not always easy, and not everyone, as we well know, has insurance.
That's right. Right, and there's a certain sort of Bloomingdale's versus Walmart kind of a question about it, too. It seems to me sometimes I'll hear that there's a drug and it costs you $5,000 a treatment. Of course, if you have Blue Cross insurance, all Blue Cross is paying is $2,000 because of the rate they've negotiated. But if you come in off the street, you're paying at the $5,000 level, or you can apply for free drug. Now, seems to me, if just doing a little basic arithmetic, if they charge like $3,000 to everybody, then maybe that would work a little better?
Oh, my. I wish I could comment. I just don't know enough about the situation. On the face of it, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. But, gosh, I just don't know everything that goes into these decisions,
right.
How pricing is determined, or any of that.
Yeah, marketing and pricing is a bit of a black art. So
it's its own, I won't call it a science, but it's its own area of interest.
Right. Now tell me, when we're talking about a newly developed drug, people can get a patent on it and go for these kinds of incentives and protections. What if there's some herbal remedy that, in fact, would be helpful for this disease, but we can't get anybody to do a clinical trial on it to determine for sure that you could put that on the label? What incentives are there for a company to undertake to get an herbal labeled for a particular disease?
Well, some of the problems with your herbal product are that we don't know enough about how they're manufactured, what's in each dose, to say that as it is, it's safe for its intended use. So the companies really do have to acknowledge that they've got to do good standardized clinical trials in order to show that that product does work to help patients.
Can they get any patent protection if they do that, or some way to make back
that
money?
They can get exclusivity. Mm-hmm. How much weight it will carry, I don't know, because it depends if there are other such herbal remedies available in the health food stores. Mm-hmm. But those herbal remedies may not advertise for that particular treatment, whereas if you have FDA approval, you may advertise that it works, and it works for patients, and here's how it works, and this is why it is appropriate for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's getting past that clinical trial barrier is sometimes an enormous challenge.
I don't disagree with you at all.
So what happens if, as you said, there's only 500 patients in the United States, we're trying to put a clinical trial together, good luck getting enough patients to make a statistical difference. How does one handle a situation like that?
It's highly variable. If you have a very effective drug, you will show that it works in those 500 patients. Now, clearly you're not going to have all 500 in a clinical trial.
Right.
But, if you even had 25, and that was a very effective drug, you would be able to show that that drug worked. FDA is looking carefully, and others are as well, to find new ways to evaluate drugs, find new ways to look at drug development. Because you're entirely correct. It's not easy to find ways to develop these products. Not every drug is very effective. Some are not. And the diseases are not caused by one gene. Some of them are caused by a variety of genes. And what we see, it all looks like the same disease. But in actuality, it's not quite. We need to be able to differentiate that. And our science is just getting to that location for the best interest of patients.
Right. So like breast cancer, for example, not all breast cancer is the same thing. There are, in fact, many different diseases within that general category.
All of which are classified as breast cancer. But they may be breast cancer A, B, C, D, E. And I think in time we will get to that and know what we're looking at better. The human genome was only fully described a relative short time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And while everybody hoped that it would be the be-all, the end-all, and it certainly has taught us a lot, we still have a lot to learn.
Right, and as Dr. Collins says, we may know how to spell it, but we don't know what it all means. So,
you bet.
So all we know so far is how to spell the human genome, but there's a lot. And even things like the junk DNA, they used to call it, the pieces that they thought really weren't doing anything, they're finding out, in fact, do some important things.
Absolutely.
So there's a tremendous amount yet to learn about the human genome.
We have a huge amount to learn. The more we learn, you know, the more we find out there is to learn.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and the other challenge in cancer is that once one thing goes wrong, then there's a kind of waterfall effect. There's all kinds of other things then that go wrong downstream, as they say. So A pushes B, and B pushes C, and C pushes D, and all of a sudden you've got a whole group of things that went wrong.
Right.
So adding two drugs together sometimes helps and sometimes doesn't help. And I know in kidney cancer now we've got something like 25 new drugs in the pipeline, as they say. So there's four or five already on the market and more on the threshold and getting into approval. And the challenge is, number one, how are we going to test that many drugs by themselves and prove that they're better than nothing or better than the other drug that was approved before? And secondly, what combinations are we going to want to try? If you try to do combinations of two or three of 25 drugs, that's an almost infinite number of combinations, and we're going to run out of patients.
True.
Are there any ways that FDA is working on, or things that you're familiar with, whether they're at FDA or not, for how to deal with that kind of an issue?
There is something called the Critical Path Initiative that was put forward by FDA 1 or 2 years ago now, maybe a little bit more. That initiative is looking at what are the best ways to do this. Can we do it by something called surrogate endpoints, markers that look like they may really determine whether a disease is being well treated or not? Are there biomarkers of disease that if you follow those biomarkers there properly, that they can show that the disease is being well treated? Just, there's a lot of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are 100% foolproof. We're still looking at the best way. And, you know, we get further every day, but we're not quite there yet.
Right. And just to define a couple of the terms that you use, because they're important terms to know about when we're talking about these endpoints, help me out with this if I get this wrong, but an endpoint is like, what are we trying to achieve, guys? How would we know when we're there? And so we define an endpoint that says the tumor got smaller, for example, and then that gives us something to look for. Is that more or less right, or do you want
That's
to expand on that?
That's more or less right, but if the tumor got smaller, we still would like to know whether the patient lived longer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes sense that the tumor gets smaller and the patient does better, but we need to know that for certain. Because just when you think that something is, we discover it is not. Many times side effects from drugs become obvious many years after a drug has been approved by the FDA. We need to look at these things in great depth, because the one thing we don't want to do is harm patients.
Right.
The other thing we want to do, though, is be sure that patients have access to safe products as quickly as they can.
And that's an interesting challenge, because I know the AIDS community, for example, lobbied for faster tracking of a lot of drugs because the need was so keen. You know, come on, help me out with this drug. Even if it helps a little bit, it's better than nothing. So there's a clamor often from the patient groups to have it fast, fast, fast. And yet, as you say, sometimes those side effects don't show up for 5 or 10 years. We sometimes need 5 or 10 years worth of experience with a drug in order to know whether down the road this might have another kicker in it that we just didn't know about at the time.
Right. And then we have to look at the risk-benefit. You know, it could be that, you know, we're willing to take that risk, whatever that side effect is, because very few, if any, drugs are completely side effect-free.
Right.
But you have to know what your risk is. You want to be able to make an informed decision that I am taking this drug. I know that it has problems, but my problems are greater than...
Right. If I don't take the drug, I'm going to die. So I take the drug, and 2 years from now, I have a different kind of a problem. Is that trade-off worth it?
Yeah. And the patient needs to be part of that decision-making.
Right, right. Yeah, and as you say, depending on the size of those two problems, I could opt to do it or not to do it. And
yeah.
Also, depending on the general state of my own health. I talked to somebody the other day, his 87-year-old stepfather is going through chemotherapy and radiation because he has colon cancer. And later in the car, my mother and I had a conversation about if I were 87 and in that pickle, would I even do radiation or chemotherapy, or if I would just say, you know what, guys, game over. And I think we all have to make those decisions, and nobody can make that decision for someone else.
No one can make it for someone else. That's absolutely correct. And what I might want for myself, sibling or relative might not want.
Right. Right. But there is a cost factor in there, too. And as you say, we don't all have the privilege of choosing that because we don't all have insurance. And if we get into a situation, well, we're all always in a situation where there's a finite pot of money. It's a matter of how are we going to spend that money, whether it's buying a house or a car or deciding to buy this new drug or not, we're always making those sort of, am I going to buy it, am I not going to buy it kind of decisions.
There are trade-offs in everything we do. You know, are we going to go on vacation this year, or are we going to have the house painted?
Right.
Or, you know, are we not going to be able to do either of those things?
You know, when the UK said they weren't going to pay for Avastin because it was too expensive, and they said, you know what, we're only willing to pay $50,000 for one more quality year of life. And then there was a big outcry saying, oh, the UK is denying patients this wonderful drug. And part of me said, you know, I'm kind of glad that somebody drew a line in the sand and said, you know what, this is all I'm willing to pay, because no matter what you're selling, it comes a point when the market's no longer willing to buy it at that price.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right. However, when it's you or when it's your loved one, somehow the decisions look very different.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And that's really hard to acknowledge.
Right, but... Even if we said, you know, I would pay anything, do we have it in the bank?
Right, and do we have anything? We don't.
Right.
We don't.
Right, so we have to look at this realistically, and at a certain point, as much as we don't want to measure people's lives in dollars and cents, there are dollars and cents decisions to be made, whether we're writing a check or the insurance company's writing a check.
Correct. Correct. No, you are absolutely correct. And, you know, we have to acknowledge that that is the world in which we find ourselves. And it's not a bad place. We end up making better decisions in the long run when we really have to think things through rather than just spending more money.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about design of clinical trials for rare diseases, because this is a concern that I have all the time, and because the community I work with primarily is people with von Hippel-Lindau disease,
right,
which is a genetic cancer syndrome, and it's a relatively small population, about 9,000 people in the United States. But obviously, we want to keep our people as healthy as we can for as long as we can. And when the clinical trials, which are just beginning to emerge for this condition, and this happens a lot in rare diseases, it'll be held at one place in the United States. So, for example, there's a clinical trial right now in Houston with Sutent for VHL. It's in one place. You have to go to Houston once a month for a year at your own expense, stay in a hotel. You have to pay for the doctor's visits and a certain number of the scans that they don't consider to be critical to the clinical trial, but more, quote, routine, unquote, scans, though there's more than there would be if you were just watching your own health. So it's expensive, both in terms of time and in terms of dollars, and in terms of time away from your family and your job. It's expensive for the patient to participate in this trial. So ideally, what we would like is for the clinical trial to be at multiple sites or for the pharmaceutical to help us with the travel. And it becomes a real quandary when you try to get people to sign up for the trial, how they can fit this into their lives. Is this something you could comment on for us a bit?
It does seem unfair. And one would hope that there would be a way to find some money for these sorts of things. What is available in the stimulus package right now, I do not know. But be that neither here nor there, drug companies, too, have finite amounts of money. And that's just the way the ball game is. And much as we would like it if companies could pay for more, they can't always do it either. And they're saying, well, gee, you know, we are developing this product. These are very difficult questions. They're unfair in many ways, and yet it's very hard to figure out what the fairness factor could be differently. I heartily agree that it is just very, very difficult for patients. And there are times that, you know, what you end up doing is maybe not even getting all the right people into the clinical trial by virtue of your patient selection.
Yep, exactly. Well, and also in these days of, you know, telephone and FedEx and internet, it seems like sometimes we go to that single site and then they draw the blood and send it FedEx to the lab. Why couldn't I have stayed home, have my doctor draw the blood and send it to the same lab?
These are all issues of controlling the trial. Now, there are trials that are, even in very small patient groups, that are conducted in a variety of sites. These are the decisions. Those decisions are actually made by the drug company. That is not something that FDA can dictate to the company for the most part.
Or is this something that might come under that assistance from the Orphan Product Development Group that the pharmaceutical could somehow work out with the FDA a reasonable plan for this drug that would hopefully balance the needs of the patients and the needs of the pharmaceutical company?
I do not know if the Office of Orphan Products would be willing to take something like that on. That's not been their traditional role. And, you know, I'm no longer working there, so
sure.
I can't really speak for them. It might be something that they could get involved in. But you need to know more, or I would need to know more, about why is this only being done in one site?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a rationale for that? And if so, what is it? And would there be another way to handle the situation?
Right. I mean, sometimes it seems to me that whoever is designing the trial, and as you say, it's probably the pharmaceutical company, is trying to limit the number of variables. So they want one scanner machine, one MRI machine, one guy reading it. They want all of the scans to come to that one person, or all the pathology to go to one pathologist, to try to limit the number of variables in the study. And I can understand from a scientific perspective at least the need for some of that, but it seems to me that one could try to standardize that, and at least after some startup period in the trial, to try to be a little bit more flexible on those points. Do you think that there's a true need for that kind of scientific minimization of variables, or to what extent can we be flexible?
Yeah, and I don't know the factors well enough. And what I would recommend to you, as I've had a moment to think about it here on the phone, is that has the patient group gone to speak with the drug company?
Mm-hmm.
And what has the answer been?
It's been a varied set of answers. I know the first clinical trial that I tried to push back on, I was in, 96, I think. And I said to them, you're going to have a real hard time recruiting patients for this trial, because I can see right now that there are three things that people are going to say, wait a minute, I just can't do that. And they said, yes, but this is what we need. And 2 years later, they had five people in the trial. And so to a certain extent, this has had to just kind of percolate and let them experience it. Now I'm talking with the third clinical trial group, and they are listening. So I think, you know, for them to experience the problems in accrual, as they say, recruiting patients into the trial, that they're beginning to realize that if they want the right number of people to really prove their case, they're going to have some flexibility here.
You know, it's possible that the Office of Orphan Products Development would meet with you and then meet with the company, or meet with the three of you together.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, I'd better not open my mouth and make any promises.
No, I know you can't commit to it, of course, but I appreciate your perspective on it. Great. We have a couple of callers on the line. Let's see. 641. Is that you?
That's me.
That's you. So we have an 827 number. Who are we talking with here? Hi. Well, I'm not sure. We've got someone with 301-827.
Oh, that might be me. I wasn't calling for a question, actually. But this is, I am with Office of Orphan Products, and we are always happy for people to call us if they have any questions at all, where we could be of help to them.
Thank you. And who are you with the Office of Orphan Product Development?
This is Deborah Lewis with Office of Orphan Products.
Hi, Deborah. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Do you have anything else that you wanted to add while we have you on the line?
Well, we just really appreciate any programs on rare diseases that bring these important issues forward, and whether it's recruitment or any other issues, it's a hard area sometimes for people to make progress, but it's so important, and it's really a rewarding place to work, and so we really appreciate the program.
Thank you.
I appreciate the work that Dr. Hafner has done over the years.
Well, let me just comment. Dr. Lewis has been with the Office of Orphan Products Development for a long period of time, and she's extraordinarily knowledgeable. And that office has a wonderful website, incidentally, and patients should access that website if they have questions. It is www.fda.gov and then /orphan.
Great,
and
thank you.
You'll find lots and lots of answers to questions on that website. I recommend that, you know, if you have questions, take a look.
Now, Marlene, I understand that your new enterprise, Hafner Associates, is hoping to further treatment and prevention of rare diseases, quote, through assistance to patient groups and assisting the pharmaceutical industry in the development of products for those devastating diseases, unquote. So can you tell us a little bit more about that and how an organization for rare disease like mine might work with you?
Well, the best way to work with me is to pick up the phone and call me. Let's figure out what the issues are and what assistance you might need. My company is fairly new. I've been around as a company for less than 3 months, just about 3 months, and I'm just getting started. But having been with the Office of Orphan Products for a long period of time, and knowing the folks there and knowing what they can do and, quite frankly, what they cannot do, I think I can provide assistance in, you know, how do I go about getting my drug approved, or how do I go about finding the researchers that might be willing to help me, or just a variety of issues and questions like that.
Great. Now, that sounds good, and I'm sure that there are folks listening who will be ringing your phone here pretty shortly.
Yeah, my phone, incidentally, I don't know whether you have it up on the web, is 301-641-4268.
Okay, thanks. And I'll put that in the handout that goes with this show, which will be up on powerfulpatient.org, certainly by the end of this weekend. So we wish you good luck with all your new venture.
Well, and thank you.
Great. Is there anything else that we didn't explicitly cover that you would like to be sure to share with people before we go?
There's a lot of good support groups out there for patients with rare diseases. If you have questions, contact either NORD, the Office of Rare Diseases at the NIH, which was not mentioned earlier today, or the Office of Orphan Products Development, or me, and we'll try to seek out answers for you.
Great. Yes, and all those offices have been very helpful and are always willing to talk with organizations for rare diseases, or if there is no organization for your rare disease, call them anyway. So start with NORD, find out if there is an organization, and then work with these federal offices to see if there's some progress that can be made. Well, thank you. We really appreciate your being with us. And Dr. Lewis, thank you very much for calling in. And we hope that everybody will take the bull by the horns here and try to work with the pharmaceutical companies. The pharmaceutical companies are not the enemy. I know sometimes people get to thinking that they are because they're, you know, charging an arm and a leg or something, but realize that they are making a very major investment in just finding the drug and then going through the approval process and the clinical trials process. As Dr. Hafner said, that can cost them as much as $800 million to $1 billion with a B. And so they're not going to spend that money, obviously, unless they have some promise of making it back. They are in business, of course, to satisfy their investors, not just as a charity. So let's work together here and see if we can balance the needs of the patients with the needs of the pharmaceutical companies and the watchdogging that the federal government is trying to do to make sure that we don't bring a drug to market that has problems. So, and as we said, those are all not easy questions. So let's work together and make sure that we can, in fact, advance the health of all the people of the United States and all the people in the world. And one of the challenges we face in rare diseases is that we are not confined to the United States. Our population is worldwide. In VHL, we have people in 106 countries. And so that's the other problem. We have many regulatory agencies to work with. Let me ask you one more quick question that popped into my mind just now. What kinds of cooperative things can be done on an international level to try to do clinical trials and approval? Are there any organizations that are working together, like FDA with Europe, for example?
Yes, that's a very important question. FDA and the European Medicines Agency does work together because, as you have said so well, rare diseases don't recognize borders. Mm-hmm. They occur across borders. And furthermore, you know, clinical trials can be done in places other than the United States if that's the best way to accrue patients. So, you know, that's really important to patients and to pharmaceutical companies. Companies don't always understand that either. So it's good for both to know that.
So if a clinical trial were held, let's say, in India, and the drug seems to do extremely well there and the papers are written and so forth, it's recognized in India, to what extent would the U.S. respect those findings, or would it need to be redone in the United States?
They would not necessarily need to be redone in the United States, but one would need to be certain that as the trials were done in India, that the data, that the collection of those trials or the carrying out of those trials was done with the same patient protections. Mm-hmm. As are done in the U.S., and that the data is indeed good data and solid data.
So that would all be reviewed and validated?
Absolutely.
If it all checked out, then it might be respected in another country.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's true, you know, not just for the U.S., but that is how the European agency operates and many of the other drug agencies around the world.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hafner. We really appreciate your being with
us. The pleasure's been mine. Thank you very much.
Right. And next week we're going to have a program where we're going to talk with some of the people who are attending the VHL meeting on Saturday in Anaheim, California. So if you're anywhere near Anaheim, come join us. We're at the Hyatt Orange County. It's actually Garden Grove, but it's right next door to Anaheim, California, and a very easy little shuttle distance to Mickey Land. But we're there primarily to talk about advances in the treatment of von Hippel-Lindau disease and its various tumors, hemangioblastomas of the central nervous system, retinal tumors, and pheochromocytoma, an adrenal tumor that occurs in many places. So, and also just the whole act of managing your health. There are two excellent talks on nutrition that are scheduled for there. One of them is about the polyphenols that occur in pomegranate juice and the benefits that are being seen with using those with kidney cancer. This is new research from UCLA. So I hope you'll join us, and we're going to talk with some of the patients who attend that meeting, and we'll have that report for you next week on Thursday at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. So meanwhile, I hope you have a great week. Be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks.
Thank you.